Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. Caroline, unfortunately, won't be able to join us today, although as our author, who's also named Caroline, we were just discussing that this would have been a perfect one for her to participate in. Our author today is Caroline Paul, and she's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Gutsy Girl, Escapades for Your Life of Epic Adventure, and also Lost Cat, A True Story of Love, Desperation, and GPS Technology, which has been translated into 15 languages. She's also author of the memoir Fighting Fire, the middle grade book You Are Mighty, A Guide to Changing the World, and the novel East Wind Rain. Her TED Talk, To Raise Brave Girls, Encourage Adventure, has been viewed over 2 million times. She is a longtime member of the Writer's Grotto and lives in San Francisco. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Caroline.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
So there's so much in there. It's like, is there anything you haven't written? Novel, memoir, middle grade reader, and these other books that are kind of essays in a way, but they're essays with a purpose.
Which one?
Well, like Tough Broad, yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, that's not essays for sure. That's definitely a full narrative with some themes that run through. I mean, this is actually when I started the book, I was very clear that it's not going to be profiles of women adventurers. It's going to be about fulfilling aging. And then each chapter does look at something as a whole that fits into fulfilling aging, but it's definitely not. It's definitely a full narrative.
Well, it is, but I would also say each chapter kind of stands on its own.
Yeah, and thank you for that. I mean, if somebody says, "Oh, I'm a bird watcher," they could go immediately to the bird watching chapter. But I think you lose the big ideas. So
yeah. So Gutsy Girl was written for very young women, right, or girls?
Yeah, like probably like 9 to 12, right before you hit puberty is what I was hoping.
And when did you write that? When did that come out?
2016.
Okay. And so now we're looking at the opposite end. Tough Broad is aimed at women 50 and up?
Yeah, I mean, people have been telling me more like 40, even 30 seems to become relevant. So.
Well, I got to say, so the subtitle is From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. And is this you wing walking on the cover?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
That is just so terrifying. But that's, I got to say that, like, to me, it's sort of as an older woman, that even 50, it's like, what are they talking about? They don't have any limitations. You don't have any limitations at 50. You can do anything.
That's not what I saw my friends. I mean, my friends are really disheartened about aging. Oh, and, you know, and I'm not immune to the messaging that tells us that our future is, you know, sort of frail bones and cognitive decline. And that was what interested me, because when I was outside on my surfboard or on my electric skateboard, and I also fly experimental planes, I either saw zero women or hardly any, and yet I saw a lot of men my age and men older. So I saw that there was something going on.
Yeah. Well, I totally agree that, and also I love the title Tough Broad, and I've actually started referring to myself that way.
Oh, good. Good.
Because I am. But good. I'm not as maybe outdoor adventurous as you are. To me, like, it was a major adventure to go on the Velociraptor with my grandson a year or so ago, which is the huge roller coaster at Universal in Florida. And it was, you know, terrifying in a way. And I couldn't keep my eyes open. But it was also very thrilling. And I was really glad I did it. You know, I only did it because he really wanted to go and nobody else would go with him. And so...
Well, that's what this book is about. It's really about pushing comfort zones.
Yeah.
Like, not even, though, because getting outside is also can be seamless, because you just step outside and you often we automatically feel better. What I really want to stress is that my own definition of adventure changed throughout the writing of this book. This book really was a quest. I did not come into it understanding completely what it was going to be about. I knew I didn't want it to be profiles of, you know, women. I want it to be, what it became, which was an in-depth look at the science and the psychology of fulfilling aging and how the outdoors and doing something in it is crucial to that.
So what did you learn that most surprised you?
Well, I learned for one that my definition of adventure, which was kind of that you had to have high adrenaline, you had to be constantly taxing yourself, and it almost had to kill you, was wrong. That adventure can be had if you just are pushing your comfort zone, if you feel exhilaration, if you have an exploratory outlook, and if you're being physically vital, which could mean being on the roller coaster because you're certainly feeling all your bodily emotions there, you know, and or just taking a walk outside. Or in my case, I also went bird watching. Yes, I learned to fly a gyrocopter, but I went bird watching with somebody.
I love that you didn't just limit this to the high adrenaline adventures.
Well, yeah, because I mean, what was clear to me pretty early on, I got the contract for this book in early 2020. So I started reaching out to women. I sort of hucked myself into it like a paraglider would, the paraglider that I am or used to be. I don't paraglide anymore, but I, for many years I did. And that's basically running off a cliff and with an inflated parachute of sorts. And so I just thought I would just kind of throw myself in, start talking to people. But when the pandemic hit, nobody wanted to be interviewed because we were all in lockdown. So I had to do a lot of research just with the computer, and which turned out to be great for the book, because what I came away with was a really good foundation of the science of fulfilling aging. And what was becoming very clear to me was that going outside is really important for not just our physical health, because, of course, you could get physically fit in the gym, but our whole well-being. And, you know, the science is unequivocal on that. Like going outside where the bird song calms your brain, where the architecture, I guess one would say, of Mother Nature is just soft, rounded lines, fractal. It actually, this surprised me, it really fits well with the retinal structure of our eyes. And so the mere processing of the outdoors is easier for our brain, and people test much better cognitively and with memory after taking a walk outside. So I knew I wanted people to get outside and that people were not doing that as they aged. So of course I wanted a broad spectrum of quote adventures, but I have to say I went into some of them thinking that's not really an adventure, but I really want to include it. And then being completely schooled, I went on a walk with a 95-year-old woman named Dot Fisher Smith, and the way she walked with such exuberance and also paying attention to everything very closely. And also, frankly, in this zigzag way, she called it beshert. She just kind of walked where the universe suddenly maybe told her to veer left because look at that tree, or go right because that beautiful little pond.
So through people's yards, through right. Wherever. And I like that you acknowledged that there was a certain amount of white privilege that allowed you to do that.
Oh, yeah, no,
I appreciate that.
Right. This book is very much for everybody in the outdoors, and the outdoors has been unwelcoming to a wide swath of us women, but definitely people of color. And I look into the history of that, and because we, you know, don't think people of color want to be out there, and it's just not true. First of all, I've interviewed quite a few people who told me how it had changed their lives. And so, yeah, I'm very clear that, you know, the role that white privilege plays in the outdoors, feeling more welcome to those of us who are white.
Yeah. When you mentioned looking around and not seeing a lot of women your age or older at these doing these different things, when standing in line for the Velociraptor, I was definitely the oldest woman in that line.
Right.
And yeah, and probably the oldest person overall, though maybe not. But, you know, it was, and that made me feel even better about myself.
Right. Well, that's the cool thing. There is a virtuous cycle to some degree when you upend other people's expectations of what you do, but you're also upending your own expectations. And when I was doing my research, first of all, I came into it very clear that we do get subliminal messaging that is very toxic as we age for women. And that was being played out as I didn't see women in the outdoors, but men were. And then I found science that said, and this really turned my head around, the way we look at our own aging predicts how well we age. So if you have a negative view of your own aging, you will experience cognitive decline earlier and your chances of a cardiac incident also earlier. And the opposite is true. If you have a positive view of your, if you think that your older age is going to be full of exploration and exhilaration, you will be happier and you will be healthier and you will live 7 years longer. That is what really started me on this trajectory, because it became clear to me that there was this virtuous feedback when you go outside, because what nature asks of you when you go outside is a rebuke to all that messaging. You're not frail. You can't be cognitively on a decline, and you're certainly not boring.
Right, right. Wow. So is there anything else that really surprised you? There were a couple things that I can't remember what they were now, but in the science that kind of surprised me.
Right. Well, that first is that, you know, the way we look at our own aging is so important, so vital. So that also, I was really surprised by some of the our brain plasticity. One of the things I was looking
at. Yes, that was it. That was it.
Well, I came away from my research realizing that there's basically five really important things we need to keep as we age. We need them at any age, but they tend to fall away. And that is community, purpose, health, this positive mindset about your own aging, and novelty. And so for novelty, so I looked at outdoor adventure and how they fit into giving us all those things rather seamlessly. So for novelty, I was looking at people who learn something new in the outdoors. It turns out a lot of the women I talked to did pick up outdoor adventure later in their life. And I spoke to one woman named Vijaya Srivastava, who had zero outdoor experience growing up. And she was now at 68. Her doctor recommended that she do some exercise and said, why don't you swim in that pool that you happen to have in your condominium complex? And Vijaya said, I don't know how to swim. And the doctor said, I prescribe you lessons. Vijaya is somebody who's super fun. And she saw kids in the pool and she saw how fun it looked, but she didn't think it was something accessible to her. So the doctor said this, and she enlisted a friend and they went and took swimming lessons at 68. And the amazing thing is that I asked friends of mine, when was the last time you learned something new? And most of us have not learned something new in a long time. And that's in some ways good. We know who we are. We know what we like. But novelty is really important for our brain. And since there's a lot of things that concern us as we age about our brain, memory, you know, just sharpness in general, we need to keep challenging it. And there's things like, of course, sleep, nutrition, but novelty isn't one of them. So watching people learn something new was obvious to me. It was good for their brain. But not only that, because what Vijaya told me is that once she learned to swim, she realized, oh, what else can I do? And so, again, it was that mindset where she upended one part of herself by actually swimming, surprised herself, and thought, oh, I see. My life is bigger than I thought.
I love that you included women in here who were doing things that, first of all, who didn't have this long history of being really active and adventurous and physically active, because sometimes, you know, after you've been fairly sedentary for a number of years, you think, well, it's too late. It's too late for me to change that. So I love that you gave examples of people who did change it, and also that some of the things they did were maybe not considered that special or unique, and yet the angle that you took in describing it did make it special. You know, and this woman being, you know, learning to swim, being a prime example of that. And because for those of us who grew up swimming, it seems like, oh, well, that's not a big deal. But it was a big deal, and it changed her life.
I mean, I went and hung out with some boogie boarders down in San Diego. They call themselves the Wave Chasers.
Oh, it made me want to do that. Absolutely.
I know, right?
Yes.
Well, I came down there not really thinking that it was an adventure, but that it was something that would be easy for people to learn because it's so simple. It is a sport that kids do. Boogie boarding, for anybody who might not know, is when you take a little flotation device. And if you're the Wave Chasers, you just stand in the white water and the white water comes and you drop onto your belly and get propelled into shore. But the very simplicity of it is kind of why it was so powerful. So I spoke to a woman named Lorraine Voigt. She had joined the Wave Chasers at 60 during the pandemic. So it was kind of a inflection moment, which is the way a lot of people change their life. They've been shook up heart-wise, neurally, probably, you know, you lose a partner, you move to a new town, you retire. There's all these sort of possible inflection points. And the pandemic was one of them. And Lorraine was on the beach and she did not even like the ocean. She didn't have an outdoor life. She was a little discombobulated in general, she told me. And she saw these women, they looked like they were just having fun. She thought, well, why don't I just try it? And why not try it? Like, you can always not do it after that. And she fell in love with it. And she told me, Caroline, boogie boarding changed my life. And wow. It still gives me goosebumps right now because I couldn't understand in that moment, like, what a little simple sport like boogie boarding that 10-year-olds do changed her life. When she explained it to me, it made so much more sense, which was basically that, you know, look at me. She was 62 at the time I spoke to her. Look at the big Pacific Ocean, how cold it is. Look at the wind. Look at the way I'm tumbled in the waves. It had upended her expectations of herself as, you know, not somebody who is physically vital. And look at how much fun I'm having. That was the other thing. And look at how I'm not culturally irrelevant like I've been told. Like, it basically had that powerful effect of upending, again, her expectations of herself and her future. And that was a domino of all these other things in her life that started to open up. And that's when I really began to understand the power of just pushing, just feeling exhilaration on your own terms, pushing your comfort zone just on your own terms. She didn't even feel like she was pushing her comfort zone when she was getting out there. She knew how to swim. She just was like, I don't really like it. And then all these things just subtly started. Then comfort zones were pushed subtly, but she was having so much fun, she probably hardly noticed.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Caroline Paul, author of Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. You really do cover a wide gamut of activities, but there's some, you know, like, I don't think you had skiing in here, and there's some. So how did you decide which ones to include and which ones to leave out?
I didn't want to include any activities that were financially, stressful, like skiing. I mean, skiing costs a lot. Cross-country skiing I wanted to cover, or snowshoeing. I just couldn't find anybody in that moment. And I was also finishing the book within a certain amount of time. So the winter was just it just didn't really work out. But I really I looked for an ice swimmer. I looked hard for people. And again, it was probably my own research abilities falling down. But I also hired a researcher because it felt like it was difficult to find women of a certain age out, just because we don't promote ourselves perhaps as much as maybe the younger generation or that men do. Not a critique at all, but it's just, we don't trumpet our own exploits that much.
Yeah.
So I did hire somebody who did find people by scouring the internet. And of course I told people I was working on this book and they recommended friends. So one of the surprises, if we get back to that question, is that there were more women out there. And as one of the Wave Chasers told me, we want adventure. And it's true. It's just that I think there's lots of obstacles that I hope Tough Broad removes for people.
Bicycling is one of the things that you have in here. You have a BMX biker from Iowa, which is where I am right now. And you want to tell us a little bit about her? She just seemed amazing.
Sure. I was interested in looking at competitive sports, but not that interested. So I wanted to definitely include it because I knew competitive sports were good for youth because they honed leadership skills. They made us more had risk assessment, decision making. There was all this great skills that come with competitive sports, goal setting. And so I did interview a triathlete, and that was great. But I then came upon a BMX bike racer named Kitty Westernauer. She's the oldest female BMX racer today. She's 74 when I interviewed her. And she taught me how to bike race, which is BMX bike racing is not what I thought it was. I did think I was going to have to do some tricks on some jumps. But as Miss Kitty, which is her racing moniker, told me, Caroline, you watch too much TV. It's basically going around a track, and it has some steep turns and some rollers that you might get a little bit of air. I didn't get any air, and it's a circuit around the country. And what was really great is that I went in thinking I was going to be covering a certain aspect, like how competition improves our sense of purpose and maybe ups our neural, activity somehow. But what I really found is that even though BMX racing is an individual sport, that it's really about the community. Like Miss Kitty had a community, and that is something that drops away as we age. And more than that, she had what's called deep belonging. I think that's a scientific term, but it's when you're an integral part of something. There's a cultural apparatus around you. So that's why, for instance, yes, a book club is great, or having a religious practice where you actually, have a church that you go to or a mosque, any kind of apparatus around you that gives you a sense of belonging really, really ups your happiness. And turns out sports do that too, as does any outdoor activity like hiking that you might do in community, or you think you're not doing in community, but you run into people on the trail, on the slope.
Yeah, I gotta, in bicycling, I have a sister-in-law who's in her mid to, I guess, mid to late 50s, who is a distance bicycle racer. And she does gravel rides, like 88-mile gravel, 100-mile gravel. She's actually won 500-mile races, things like that.
Amazing.
Yeah, and beating out much younger women often. And
Right.
a lot of the men too.
Right, right,
Yeah,
right. On those
yeah,
distances, I
yeah,
think a lot
yeah.
about your mind. That's great.
Yeah, it just amazes me that she can do that.
Well, she must be encountering a lot of surprise looks and admiration on the way, or she's upending a lot of people's notions of what a woman her age can do. Bicycling is great because, again, it's like boogie boarding. It's something it's not simple per se, but what we've learned it as a kid, almost most of us have. And so my own mom took it up at 60, and it really changed her later life in a way that also set me on this journey because I realized that while the subliminal messaging is real, and I'm an American woman, I feel it. I had my own subliminal messaging and seeing my mom blossom in later life, which started at 40, then 50, and then in 60 when she found cycling. And again, she was not an outdoors person at all.
I
And
loved that. I loved your story about your mom. Yeah.
yeah, I didn't want to write about anyone I knew, but I knew that I also had to write about my mom because she was so seminal for my own journey. And this was really a book about my own quest to find fulfilling aging.
Absolutely. What made you actually decide, okay, I'm going to devote however long this took to writing this book?
Yeah, I was basically on my surfboard looking around and seeing no women my age. It was very, I remember almost the day, and I'm not a good surfer. So, and I knew there was lots of women who were better than me that weren't coming out in the conditions that I was going out in. But again, I saw men as old as 75 in winter swell. Like, I'm basically a terrible surfer, but I'm a really good paddler, and I love the wildness of a stormy day. So I go out in almost anything, which might be dumb. But if I, you know, even on big days, there would be women who could certainly handle it and were not out there. And that just made me wonder. I feel like I'm my best self outside, and I wasn't sure why, but now I have much more handle on why, because I've looked at the science. But, you know, it's a place where you can be very, you have to be very present, because there's uncertainty all around you in terms of weather, or, you know, what bird you might see, or where's the trail. And so, and also you're, you know, you're exhilarated and you're also practicing bravery. So I wanted to keep it in my life, but I thought, do people know something I don't? And maybe I should look into this.
Well, I think you knew something they didn't.
Right. Yeah.
Let's go back. You talked about the plasticity of the brain. Until I read where you were writing about the scientific research, I still believed that you can't, you know, that your brain loses plasticity and you can't, you know, develop new connections, new, what's it called, neural, whatever. I don't even know the terminology for it. And that's not, it's totally not true.
No, it's not true. And it was actually a woman who figured this out. She was herself was in her mid-40s, Marianne Diamond. Sorry, I'm getting her name wrong. But she posited, there was a prevailing belief that our brains hardened and maybe we stopped learning as early as teenagerhood. But she showed that we actually make new brain cells. We lay down new neural pathways until basically until we kind of, it's not that we never do, we stop doing it, but it might become, you might have some illness that maybe stops one part of your brain from developing as fast, which means that the brain just adapts and it lays down neural pathways. It's almost like a highway that you take an exit and then you realize, oh, it's traffic. Let me take the next exit. So it's, our brains are incredibly adaptable and they continue to be. And they've shown that actually older people think differently than, first of all, their own younger brain and younger people, because we will lay down new neural pathways in order to optimize our thinking process. Whereas it leads to innovative thinking. And this surprised me as well, because the prevailing cultural belief is that, you know, we harden, we calcify in so many ways as we age, literally and metaphorically. But the science says otherwise. And, you know, we do have to keep asking we have to exercise our brain. And so one of the other things that was very interesting to me is I was looking into memory, because that's something that we're worried about losing as we age.
Right.
And so it became clear that novelty is also important for stimulating that. But even more so, the more I did research, the more I realized that navigation and memory is in the same part of the brain. And they've known this for many years. They used to do memory challenges way back in the Greek and Roman times with learn long poems. And they realized that if you linked navigation, to whatever you're trying to memorize, then you have a much better chance of memorizing things seamlessly. So for instance, if you want to memorize pi to the millionth decimal, which is what I think is a classic memory challenge, what people do is that they construct what they call a memory palette.
I got to say, why would you want to do that?
Well, it's impressive. I mean, I think it took one person 10 hours to do the pi to the blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
Tens of millions place. But the way you do it is that you construct maybe your childhood home in your mind. You remember it. And then you assign the numbers you're trying to memorize to a place in your house and you walk through your place. So you navigate in your mind and then you place these numbers, let's say if it's pi, and that way you can memorize, you know, long, long strings. At the time, I didn't get it. When I first heard this years ago, I was like, that's weird. You have to not only memorize your a place in your head. You have to also memorize the numbers and where they go. It seemed like you were taxing your brain, but no, because it's navigating, you're using navigation as a tool. They call it method of loci. And so what was interesting to me as someone who's constantly lost, who's always disoriented, tries to figure out where north is diligently, but often doesn't know. I was interested in this, and more interested because, of course, GPS these days, we do not navigate anymore. None of us, very few of us, actually know where we are in a real sense. They simply know that the blue dot is us.
I had heard that before, that how GPS might affect our brains and how important it is to use maps once in a while. So how do you recommend dealing with that? How do you, what would you say? Because it's hard, you know, you can't drive with the map, holding the map in front of you.
I know, face. Because I tried that. You can, because we used to do it, remember?
Yeah. Well, someone else navigated. You had somebody sitting next to you
navigating.
That's
true. That is true. I tried doing it on my own because my my ex-wife was like, I am not going to do this. I have a GPS in my hand. So why? So I'd be trying to figure out the map, which is, you know, tiny, tiny writing. And I did give it up and go back to GPS. But the thing about being outside is that there's all these opportunities to navigate just on a walk, to constantly align yourself with north, south, east, west, to know where you are on a bigger plane, to... So one of the things I did was I contacted an orienteer, and orienteering is an obscure sport here, but it's very common in Europe. It's very popular in Scandinavian countries, and it's basically a race with a map and compass. As Penny DeMoss, who was 72, told me, it's running with a map and compass. So you try to get to an endpoint, but along the way, you have to stop at all these waypoints and say that you've been there. And you need to find those waypoints on a map using a map and compass paper. So it was basically thinking and running, which is also a lot of really interesting research on how you think more creatively and better while you're moving. So for all these reasons, I went orienteering with Penny.
Wow. By the way, going back to the fact that we still develop new neural pathways, can learn new things, and have brain plasticity well into our old age, could you please tell the people who say Biden's too old that? Can you please get the word out on that?
I think with age, there's other concerns. I'm a Biden fan, but but we also need new thinking, like very new cultural thinking. So at any rate, it's who wants to do the hardest job in the world? Why don't you go outside instead? So I found that really fascinating that navigation is something that improves our memory so much. And they did a study on older people using VR. So they didn't actually go outside, but they pretended they were outside and they navigated, and they tested way better on memory tests after doing that.
Wow.
So triggering the navigational part of our brain improves our memory.
That's important. That's good to know. So Caroline, would you read a little bit from your book?
Sure. I'll read from the very beginning. This is the first chapter, and I'll just kind of truncate it a little bit. So I'll skip around so I don't make it a super long reading. But I want to tell you that I was on my way to my first interview, my first Tough Broad. I was going to Yosemite, and at the gate, it was COVID. So there was a new system and you had to have a reservation. So I had a reservation and I showed it to the ranger, and she was, she said, that's not your name on the reservation, so I can't let you bring your car in. So that's where we are when I start this.
All right.
I look for a sign that the ranger will relent, but she is young and earnest and rules are rules. For a moment, there is an awkward silence. Do people walk? I ask. And she looks alarmed and tells me it's 9 miles to the valley. Then I remember my one wheel, fully charged to its 15-mile capacity and resting in the trunk. So I say, half joking and half desperate, well, can I get on my one wheel? I can see by her face that she doesn't understand. So I add, it's an electric skateboard. And she blinks rapidly, taking in the staid hatchback with the sensible gas mileage, the gray roots of my hair, the thin veil of cat dander that may be rising from my shirt, and the 1963 birth date on the ID. She repeats, electric skateboard? As if giving me time to tell her that I'm not serious, but I just nod, and she pulls her head back in the booth, then reappears moments later and says, sure, an electric skateboard is allowed. Okay, I'll be back, I say, and I watch her go momentarily still, as if already lost in the future of what she will compose on her social media feed. LOL, old lady on skateboard. I don't hold this against her. When I was her age, I was exactly the same, dumping everyone over 50 unceremoniously into a box labeled old, subdividing that further into just a few categories limited to adjectives like frail, senile, or boring. Not to mention the big one, dying. From my callow, know-it-all perspective, everyone over 50 was on the downhill slide to imminent death. So I don't feel resentful. I feel delighted and even a little bit sorry for my young ranger, who doesn't realize that soon enough, she will be where I am. For now, though, she is still certain that the world works in a particular way and that this is some sort of misunderstanding. She pins the politeness back on her face and waves me around in a U-turn. I park my car a quarter mile down the mountain. I put on my wrist guards and my helmet and my fanny pack because I may be a skateboarder, but I am still 57 years old and believe in safety first and quick access to chapstick. I remove the one wheel from the trunk, switch it on, and then step back, admiring it. So then I describe the one wheel and I it's basically a skateboard with one wheel. You look like a snowboarder, kind of. And I have a lyrical passage about going back up the mountain to the ranger hut. And then I see the rangers. I zip toward a knot of rangers outside the hut. And as they turn towards me, one shoots up her eyebrows as if she has spotted a black bear pawing, say, a lunch cooler. Could be dangerous. Don't do anything sudden. Stay calm, the look says. Someone else laughs a little, and they all stutter step away from me as if I'm about to wipe out their entire squadron of youthful shins. But I stop and dismount without incident. And then there's some passages about, me talking with the rangers. And finally, this is the end of this chapter. As I accept a map that has been proffered and answer a few wide-eyed questions about the one wheel, I can tell I have upended expectations. Yet the young rangers have also deemed me harmless. I'm a one-time zoological curiosity of sorts, a far outlier on an otherwise neatly plotted bell curve. But here's what I haven't told them. The friend whose name is on my reservation, who I am meeting, is also in her 50s, and she would also give them pause, but much, much more pause. She is a base jumper, someone who dons a parachute, and then hucks herself from buildings, antennas, spans, and earth, thus the base, B-A-S-E, of base jumpers. Tomorrow at dawn, it will be earth, specifically the earth on the rim of Yosemite's fabled wall, El Capitan. This is, of course, illegal. There is even a Yosemite Park jail for those caught doing it, and two for those like myself who serve as accessories to their crimes. But right now, to the earnest milling rangers, I am the antithesis of a future felon. I am an older white woman with a cockamamie hobby, and it is confirmed again that the reservation is needed for the car, not the human, and that I am free to continue on my skateboard. I am sent off with genuine smiles and small shakes of the head, and then the young rangers turn back to their duties, naturally assuming that there will be no more surprises, that I am otherwise just a gal with a bird list and a picnic, meeting a friend for a gawp around the valley. If they hear from me again, they are sure it will be because my friend stopped her sedan in the middle of the road and traffic piled up behind us. That's the kind of ridiculous thing those older women do when they spot something flying in the wild, the young rangers have been told. They have no inkling that what might be flying in the wild is actually one of these older women. That sets up the book.
And that was Caroline Paul reading from Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Lives as We Age. So this book is organized into four sections: spirit, body, brain, and heart. And I'm wondering, at what point in the writing process did you determine that that was going to be the underlying structure of the book? Was it while you were doing the interviews, or once you really started putting things together?
Thank you for asking that, because for me as a writer, I need two things before I can really, really execute the book. And the first is my voice. And the my voice has changed depending on the book I've written. And the second is structure. And structure is almost more important. And like I said earlier, what I knew that I didn't want this to be a book of profiles. There's lots of books of profiles, and I think they're great. But that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to write a book that had a leitmotif of me going through on this quest and then unearthing various aspects of fulfilling aging that outdoor adventure offered. And through that would be these amazing older women in the outdoors. So it ranges from my base jumper, Sean Brokman, who was 52. She was the only person who was younger than me at the time. And to sea kayaking, to bird watching, to simply going on a walk, to swimming. I learned to fly a gyrocopter. But I didn't have a sense of how this cohered as a whole. And what I realized is that I wanted it, outdoor adventure appealed to all aspects of ourselves as an older woman. So it appealed to our mindset, which is kind of the spirit aspect. It really helps our body because we become physically healthier, and our brain. And of course, there was community. So that was heart. So what I did is I organized the book based on those aspects of our body, which is spirit, body, brain, and heart. And under that came really what I was trying to say was our mindset is really important. Our physical health is really important. Our mental health is really important, and our emotional health, which would be community. So then under the mental health would be novelty. So I was actually all the pillars of aging that I identified before, those five pillars of health, community, purpose, novelty, and mindset, positive view of your own aging, is in that structure.
And was it hard to figure out where each chapter fit into that structure?
Thank you for asking that. Yes, because it turns out, well, first of all, I would go into an adventure sure that I knew where this adventure would fit into my structure. So for instance, when I went bird watching, I was very clear that I wanted to bring people outside who of all physical abilities. And the woman I interviewed is in a wheelchair, and she's been in a wheelchair since she was 14. And she started this organization called Birdability, which brings people with disabilities of all kinds outside bird watching. And so this chapter was going to be under the body, which it is, and about adaptation. So how we can adapt to our own physical limitations, as we should adapt to our financial limitations, all our other limitations. And what I came out with was a realization that bird watching was, first of all, an adventure, which surprised me because, again, I came in as this sort of high adrenaline, high octane person. And it turns out bird watching has all the rhythms of an adventure. You're on a quest. There's the anticipation when you hear the bird, you're ear birding, but you can't see it yet. Then you see it. There's, of course, the long stretches of boredom. There was the physical vitality because we were outside and we walked 6 miles because this turned out to be a birdathon. There's many types of birding. You can bird from your front porch, which some of the birders who were in wheelchairs, that's how they started because they didn't feel that they could get outside. But then as their passion for birds moved them so much, they started pushing against their own perceived boundaries and going outside still. But doing it from your porch is amazing. So even though I kept birding under the body section because it's about adaptability, I really came out with a much broader sense of birding. And so all these adventures did that for me. They all showed me that, oh, I could have put birding under heart because community was huge. So.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think there's any of these adventures that don't touch on all four.
Which exactly is why outdoor adventure is so amazing, because in one fell swoop, it offers you these all these pillars of fulfilling aging. So people have asked me, like, well, I go to the gym, so I exercise. Isn't that good? I was like, yes, that's great. Don't stop going to the gym necessarily. But it still lacks the vitality of the outdoors, the emotional well-being that the outdoors gives you for your brain. And it lacks, I mean, you can get community, but sometimes it can also offer purpose, but it doesn't necessarily offer, you know, novelty. I mean, basically, if you go outside, you are getting everything.
And don't forget vitamin D, which we get from the sun and which is so important to brain health.
Right, exactly.
So you had your basic structure and you knew some of the adventures you wanted to include, but did you have all of the different people lined up to interview before you started? And did you go out and do all the interviews, or did you and then come back and write, or did you interview someone, write that chapter, go interview someone else and write that chapter?
I knew I wanted a broad range of people, ages, and activities. So I knew that. So one of the things we touched on earlier is I want to make sure that I didn't just have white people, because there's this belief that only white people want to be outside, that there are only white people outside. And this comes from, you know, a long history of the outdoors being unwelcome to people of color, as well as women, but definitely people of color. And it, for some of the few reasons are, you know, basically, first of all, national parks didn't fully desegregate until 1964. I was already born, which meant that if my parents had been of color, I would have been raised by parents who had found the outdoors unwelcome, even dangerous. Because frankly, there was also up until, I couldn't actually tell you, but all through the 20th century, there was sundown towns where you could not be caught in these towns if you were a person of color, specifically if you were black. And so what does that do to the exploratory spirit if you can't suddenly find yourself in an all-white town that might lynch you, frankly? So that, of course, kept people from going outside. You wanted to stay where you knew it was safe. There was also redlining, which offered financial help to white people. So that allowed leisure, what we consider leisure activities, to white people, but obviously people of color who had to struggle because they were not supported by, you know, banks who would loan for business loans or homes. It all has this sort of reverberating effect. And finally, there's others, but the outdoor industry did not actually market to people of color at all. You look in a magazine, it would be a white male on the cover, white able-bodied male is what Virginia Rose, my bird watcher, wants me to say. And yes, and then it would be white able-bodied women, but only recently have people of color become, you know, been marketed to by retailers, which sets up this whole, again, subliminal messaging about who can or who should be outside. So I interviewed a wide range of people, and I wanted to make sure that it included people of color who could tell me things that I did not know as a white woman myself, and also a wide range of activities that covered, you know, land, sea, and air, basically. And I kind of wanted to do seasons, but I fell down on that.
So you mentioned that, you know, you don't want this to be profiles of women necessary. I mean, there's profiles embedded in it, but in each chapter, along with talking about the particular woman that and the sport or the adventure that you're on, you participated in all of them. You bring in science into almost every chapter, and you bring in kind of your own story into every chapter as well. And you know, it's fascinating to me how, like you said, how that narrative works throughout the entire book, I'm not sure how you pulled that off to blend all those. Can you give me a little bit about your process of doing that?
I mean, this was a quest. And I knew that, again, that I wanted this to work as a whole. So I think what happens is, first of all, when you find incredibly good stories, like these women who were charismatic, they were ordinary. Nobody was really good at what they did. Some of them were not even very good at all, frankly, but they were exhilarated and enthused and changed by what they were doing. And the power of that threaded through was amazing. Also, I think I had a healthy dose of humility. Well, not starting out like I thought I knew. And then I would get schooled by these people telling me, oh no, this is an adventure. I mean, they would never say that, but they would show me like this was life-changing. And you can't, you can't look away from that. So thank you that you say that it is multi-layered. It's almost a braided book.
Yes. Yeah. And did you write each chapter like wholly and then move on to another chapter?
I did actually, believe it or not, because it really felt like I was an amanuensis of sorts. It just kind of came through me. I was so inspired after each one. And again, I would come in thinking this, I'm going to go, I'm going to go kayaking with someone because I want to look at how loss, for instance, can be, and grief, which is something that as we age, we have to face. We tend to lose people more as we age. And I interviewed Alona Aguayo, who had lost her husband only 8 months before. And I wanted to see how the outdoors was helping her. So I had an idea that I was going to deal with grief, but I also dealt with the flip side of that, which is someone coming into their own through renegotiating how they were going to get outside when their partner was no longer there to help. So it was became a much bigger chapter as I experienced it with her and then went home and wrote it. Because as I kind of wrote it, realizing these things.
I think you had another section that you'd like to read for us.
Well, I'll just quickly. Yeah, sure.
Before we run out of time.
Sure. This is the adapt section. It starts with a little, epigraph? Like it's a quote. We all have issues. The secret to successful aging is to recognize one's issues and adapt accordingly. And that was by Jane Brody, who's 80. She's a former health columnist for the New York Times. So here's the chapter. Here is the strange and mystical language spoken this morning. Who cooks for you? Who cooks for you? Asks a woman to my left in a low chant. Tea kettle, quietly answers another perfectly sane human. Quick, pick up the beer check, whispers someone else, though there is not a beer in sight. It could be a gathering of lullaby writers, or perhaps a strange game of charades. Instead, the people around me are bird watchers, and we are in a park in Austin, Texas, where the sun hasn't even risen, and we are mere looming, lurking shadows on a windy path among trees. But the air is trilling, and these humans around me are not losing their minds. Instead, they are identifying the song of certain birds in the vicinity. We are here for what is called the dawn chorus, that time around sunrise, where birds begin to announce themselves and their randy territorial intentions before the full day begins. The weed whackers and leaf blowers are still silent, the temperature cool, the insects not yet visible enough for feeding to be in order. Instead, all around, we are being treated to the soft acoustic set, akin to some waifish 20-something singing on stage. Nothing operatic, not earth-shaking, but stirring nevertheless. This is the first of many surprises about bird watching, that bird watching is actually also bird listening. It is also bird imitating, bird speculating, bird dreaming.
And that's Caroline Paul reading from Tough Broad, From Boogie Boarding to Wing Walking, How Outdoor Adventure Improves Our Life as We Age. And I got to say that almost every chapter made me want to try the things that you talk about, except the wing walking. I wasn't quite sure about that one. and flying the gyroscope.
Right. Luckily, Monica, the cool thing about wing walking, and I think just quickly I'll say that I went into wing walking. It's a very obscure, it's not something people do. It's like skydiving. You do it once for the experience, and it is what you think. It's getting, when you're at 3,000 feet, you get up out of the cockpit and climb onto the wing and then attach yourself to the middle of the wing. And then the pilot begins to do aerobatics. And I went in there thinking I was looking for what a one-time activity would offer us in terms of changing us, you know, because people are changed after skydiving, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
They have a new sense of themselves. So I went up there, and instead, what I realized was that I was experiencing awe. And awe, it turns out, is really good for us. And nature is a surefire trigger for awe. You know, the vastness of the sky or the Grand Canyon, and of course, wing walking, which you do not have to do. And they have done studies that show, just go outside with fresh, childlike eyes. They call it an awe walk. You cultivate awe. You access awe in yourself by looking at things with wonder, and you will get the benefits of awe, which is basically, they call it a reset button for the brain, where you become more open, more curious. Biologically, your inflammatory markers go down. You become calmer, less anxious, less depressed. There's all these metrics. And they did this by studying people who went on awe walks.
Wow.
And so that's another great reason to go outside. Do not wing walk, jump walk.
Awe walk. Or like when my mother was 82, we took her hot air ballooning because she'd always wanted to do it.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was. And you had to, they lay the basket down on its side. She had to crawl in, and then they set it upright. My brothers helped her, and we all went up in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, where we had grown up, and saw it from the air. And it was awesome.
Yeah.
And Caroline, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Monica. Thank you for what you do for writers and readers and books.
We always end with a quote. And so I picked one from your book because each chapter starts with a quote. I love that. And this is from chapter one. At every phase of your life, look at your options. Please don't pick the boring ones. And that's from Barbara Hillary, retired nurse who skied to the North Pole at 75 years old. Something else I probably won't do, but I admire the people who do. So thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.